You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 15th of May 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Emma Nelson. On today's programme,
we call on the entire international community to reject these illegitimate elections, as the Arab League, the United Nations, United States, Turkey and the European Union have already done.
The Friends of Syria group of international foreign ministers gathers in London to plot a way forward over the civil war in Syria. I'll be joined by Robert Fox and Darren McCaffrey. They'll discuss that and much more, including why the word Mistral could come back to haunt the Elysee Palace. We'll talk about France's potential sale of two amphibious assault ships to Russia. And a little later in the programme. As Batman turns 75, we assess the role American comic books have played in Japan.
Give our guys, who are brilliant at comics and brilliant at cartoons, a big pile of papers and say, write a story broadly along these lines about this teenage kid who is suddenly bitten by a spider and gets superpowers, and he has to live in urban Tokyo, and suddenly you've got the Japanese Spider-Man.
And before the end of the programme, we'll ask why films like these...
Some of you ask, why did I leave Hollywood? Well, I left because I fell in love with a charming prince.
Can be the equivalent of dragging your nails down a chalkboard. We'll explore the challenges posed by the historical biopic. Why, it seems to be the case of Nicole Kidman's crack at Grace Kelly there. They don't always make it. All that, plus we'll look at the latest book releases. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. So plenty to pack into the next 60 minutes. But first, let's get the latest world news from Suzanne Chislett.
Monocle 24 News. Mass funerals have taken place in Turkey for some of the 282 miners killed in the explosion in Soma 2 days ago. More than 100 people are still unaccounted for after the blast, which shut down power deep underground. The Turkish president has visited survivors in hospital and said the entire nation shares the pain of those who lost relatives. Unions have staged a one-day strike in protest at safety concerns voiced before the disaster. Monocle's Caleb Lauer is in Istanbul.
The owner of the mine last year bragged that he had reduced the cost of extracting mine from $130 a ton to just $24 a ton. And the workers today are saying that's because he uses obsolete equipment, he doesn't have backup generators, etc., etc.
The president of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan, is to visit the village of Chibok, from where more than 200 schoolgirls were kidnapped a month ago. His government has now ruled out agreeing to release militant prisoners in return for the safe return of the teenagers. They're being held by the rebel group Boko Haram. The British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has condemned what he called Syria's ruthless, utter disregard for human life. He's hosted a meeting of foreign ministers from the Friends of Syria group in London. Mr. Hague told reporters Britain had pledged an extra £30 million, $50 million, in practical support to the opposition in Syria. And he urged the country's president, Bashar al-Assad, not to stand in next month's election and instead to step aside. A court in Sudan has ordered a woman to be hanged for adopting the Christian faith. Mariam Yaha Ibrahim was convicted of apostasy for switching from Islam. A judge gave her 3 days to recant, but she refused to return to her former faith. She's 8 months pregnant, and it's reported the court ruled she wouldn't be executed until 2 years after giving birth. Moscow insists it's not had any formal request from the Donetsk region of Ukraine for it to be absorbed into the Russian Federation. Separatist leaders in the province had said they would push for the move following the weekend self-rule referendum. It was widely criticised by the rest of Europe and the United States. The Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe has said it plans to expand its monitoring mission in Ukraine. The mission's chief, Ertugrul Apakan, has delivered a report on the situation in the country at the OSCE headquarters in Vienna.
Within 1 month's time, my expectation is that we will be 300 monitors and we will be moving to 500 in 1 or 2 months' time in order to fulfill our mandate and to be more effective and to be present almost in all parts of the country.
The five candidates for the EU's top job will take part in their biggest televised debate yet shortly. Millions of people are expected to watch Jean-Claude Juncker of the centre-right bloc, Social Democrat Martin Schulz, Guy Verhofstadt of the Liberals, Scar Keller of the Greens and Alexis Tsipras of the European Left set out why they think they should be the next European Commission president. The decision will be taken by national leaders, not the voting public. But for the first time, the government heads are supposed to take public opinion into account. Jupiter's most distinctive feature, a giant red spot bigger than Earth, is shrinking, according to scientists. NASA astronomers have been examining new images of the violent storm and say they show it's getting smaller by around 1,000 kilometres a year. The pictures taken by the Hubble Space Telescope show it's now just over 16,000 kilometres in diameter, but offer no suggestion to the reason for its change in size. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Suzanne, thank you very much indeed. Suzanne will join us again in the studio in a little under 30 minutes to bring us a quick roundup of the news. But in the meantime, you're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. A digest of today's news follows this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
It's 18.07 here in London, 13.07 if you're listening in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news, I'm delighted to say, eager and ready to go, Robert Fox, defence editor for London's Evening Standard newspaper, and Darren McCaffrey, political correspondent at the Sky News Network here in the United Kingdom. Gentlemen, a warm welcome to
the
studio.
Good evening.
Lovely to see you both. Let's begin with the continuing crisis in Syria. A meeting, as we were hearing in the news, being held this week among the so-called friends of Syria, foreign ministers from both the West and Middle East gathering to discuss the war. With Bashar al-Assad certain of re-election in 3 weeks, who do we consider to be Syria's friends? Let's start with you, Robert. This is a group that was formed as almost a counterbalance to the Russia-China opposition at the UN Security Council. Who exactly are the friends of Syria? What are they intending to do?
Ah, good question. I've been trying to read all the copy to find out what they really intend to do. And this very, very diverse group want to do very different things. What made them get together? Desperation, because the man is still there and his strongest ally, which is Iran, has declared that the war is over and Bashar al-Assad has won. I joke not, that's what the Tehran propaganda machine is saying now. No, this is frustration, desperation. The two key components are EU/NATO, alliance with the US. The US not being too public in this because Mr. Kerry has had other things on his mind, like the Middle East peace process. And the real fascinating play here is between the big regional beasts, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, which has other things on its mind, Qatar, and the UAE. And it's very subtle what's going on there. Actually, you see regional conflicts and potential regional conflicts just under the surface there. They want different things. Now, the really tough guys who call a big fight, who are principally Qatar and Saudi Arabia, want arms provided to the insurgents, probably without let or hindrance, probably they draw the line at ISIS, but the Islamic Front, certainly, and the al-Nusra Front. And they want to see asymmetric support, which will be flooding it through with ghastly weapons, which seem very simple soldier sort of stuff, but they're very useful for terrorists. Principally things like shoulder launched anti-aircraft missiles, which is the tool of the insurgent du jour at the moment. And by golly, it's going to come and bite us in the backsides, because every urban guerrilla group is going to get hold of them. And there are probably too many around already, particularly those coming from Libya, peculiarly.
Darren McCaffrey, just there, a portrait painted of an enormously disparate group. Robert there mentioning, in addition to the European bloc, the French, the Germans, the Italians, the British, etc., we then have the Middle East and conflicting areas of the Middle East as well, all coming together under the same umbrella of a very uneasy alliance.
Indeed, I can answer Robert's question about what they're trying to do. Well, according to their communique this evening, they are, of course, united in their disgust and anger at what's happening in Syria and the regime's utter disregard for human life. Now, the rest of that communique seems to have just been interwarded with dates and number of deaths rather than anything actually substantial. What they are saying is the UK, again, is saying it's going to offer £30 million to the rebels. But of course, we all know that they're not terribly keen, as Robert has rightly pointed out, for the reasons that he has, in terms of supplying weapons, because those weapons could very easily fall into hands that would not be good for those in the West as well.
And ultimately, the worry is that they might come back and hurt us in the United Kingdom.
Well, precisely. We've heard an awful lot in recent weeks, particularly from the UK government, about radicalisation. In fact, this week, David Cameron, in front of the House of Commons in the UK, was talking about hundreds of British citizens who've travelled to Syria and potential radicalisation of them. I think what we have to remember is things have actually changed. I kind of slightly have a go with this communique and say that, of course, there's a lot of condemnation of the action. But the thing is that President Assad is winning. Winning more so than he has done in certainly this time last year, and I think that puts this kind of Friends of Syria group in quite a difficult position about quite where to turn to next. We heard Tony Blair, the Middle East peace envoy, saying recently that potentially Al-Assad will have to be a caretaker president until kind of things work themselves out.
He knows him, of course, because isn't it interesting that Al-Assad and Tony Blair's contact with him was to be the path to a greater peace in the Middle East until it all went nasty and pear-shaped. I'm not blaming him. Yeah. This is the way history turns in and turns out. And you're absolutely right. You talk to Village Whitehall, not Village Westminster, and they're dead scared about jihadis, because while they know where half of them are going, they don't know where the other half are going. And the other thing which is particularly worrying, I sound like Mr. Farage here, is actually the smaller European countries which have a disproportionate representation.
Indeed.
Among these people. Belgium, and I think the Netherlands.
Talking about 800s.
Yeah.
From and what is relatively small countries.
In guerrilla and terrorist terms, that is a very big hardcore, by the way.
It's a worry insofar as in contrast to previous training programmes that have been sort of set up in the likes of Afghanistan and what have you. The young men, and in fact the young women who are going over there, are not only dedicated in their commitment to raging jihad, but they now also have these techniques which they can bring back. There is a certain sort of sophistication to the things that these people are learning when they're away. Let's move on just briefly, if we may.
Just very funny. I mean, I think in all of this, we can forget that, and we have slightly forgotten, because you're quite right, of what's happened in Ukraine and relations with Russia. I mean, we've kind of forgotten the narrative that, I mean, 200 people are dying every day in Syria. And yes, okay, it's not on our screens as much as it used to be, let's say this time last year, but I mean, we're talking about 150,000 people in the last 3 years.
Perhaps
it's a figure that's
I know
it's
you want
still
to move
growing.
On to something else, but you're absolutely right. The perception of war and conflict is very, very strange. And this week in UK, we find ourselves in a very peculiar position where two prominent human rights lawyers groups, public interest lawyers, plus a German ally, plus another junior British partner, want to take the British Armed Forces to court for misbehaving on the battlefield, and the debate has been concentrated on the International Criminal Court debate instead of exactly the thing that you've been mentioning, that war is proliferating, it is changing its face, it's still the same old business, it's very nasty people killing a lot of innocent people all over the place. And the news agenda just can't keep up with it at the moment, because we're forgetting about Iraq as well, where there is there have been very, very bad killings over the mass killings over the last year or so. But they're not isolated from us. There is a global franchise of all this, and it comes back to bite you. Not necessarily in a way you don't expect, but in a timing you don't expect.
Let's build on that idea of global franchise. A story that's left, I for one, slack-jawed in the last couple of days. We've seen the annexation of Crimea and, of course, the pro-Moscow referendum in eastern Ukraine this weekend. It's cast Russia back into the role of the world's bad guy, with commentators drawing Cold War comparisons almost immediately. Moving away from Syria, but keeping within the arms world, out of all this crisis recently springs a revelation that two amphibious assault ships could well be on their way to the Russian military, supplied by the French. Now, we've had the French today talking, meeting with the Friends of Syria, within the Friends of Syria group. At the same time, they appear to be serving Russia with hardware, military hardware, on a scale that could not only could actually pose a threat to the NATO allies who France is part of.
Yeah.
Chaos.
Chaos. But you see, this is where we are, that France and Britain particularly, and it's right across the piece amongst the European NATO allies, are facing cuts. And yet they want to maintain, and it's an awful piece of jargon, but you'll be very well acquainted with it, a sovereign capability of defence manufacture. Britain, for instance, clings onto this thing. It must be able to make its own submarines. The French, likewise, have to feel that because they have their own truly independent nuclear weaponry, because the Americans don't help them as much as they help the Brits in that. And they've got to keep their defence industries going. This is what's going on with these Mistral ships. They say, well, if we don't sell them, if we hold up, if we abort the deal, then the whole of naval shipbuilding, of surface ships, could collapse. I mean, it's absolutely dreadful. But I don't think we should pillory the French too much. I mean, this is why, to use a coin a phrase, Cameron and Osborne are so pilly-wally about Putin, because of the $30 billion hot money coming in from the oligarchs and from Russian funds through the City of London. Angela Merkel, similarly, 60% dependent on Russian gas, and two of her predecessors making cooing and lovey-dovey stories, including Mr. Schroeder, who is the vice president of Gazprom and had a 70th birthday party in St. Petersburg. And rather more surprisingly, it's Helmut Schmidt saying, we must understand what the Russian case is. It's very difficult to understand the Russian case.
I think we have to remember that this deal is worth, what, 1.2 billion euros?
I mean, the thing
the French economy is not in good state. We've heard from Mr. Hollande saying that he will not stand again if unemployment is higher in 2017. This is 1,000 jobs, so it's quite important.
This is also, though, Robert just mentioned Russia and they're sort of rattling towards Angela Merkel. You know, 60% of your energy comes from Russia. Don't ever forget it. The Russians have tweeted, no less, that if France doesn't send these warships, then they will lose work. It's that real sort of holding rattling
even
your
worse,
chain.
That the French contracts can't be trusted in the future. So this is not just a sign to the Russians, but a sign to anyone else who wants to do business with the French. And as Robert only wells know, I mean, all countries do pretty murky deals with countries that they possibly shouldn't necessarily do so.
But step up Matteo Renzi, the new Prime Minister of Italy.
And I haven't heard that for a while.
And God knows Italy is dependent on Russian and East European gas. But he fired the head of the State Energy Corporation, which is a global player. It's the new seventh sister, or the seventh and a half sister, ENI. Mr. Paolo Scaroni got it, and I have heard him only this year saying we should be friends of Russia, forget about NATO. If you have NATO, it's no good unless it has Russia inside. It took very much certainly the Schroeder line on this, and it cost him. Which is amazing. Yeah. And he sacked him for that. It's the only point of principle by a head of government that I've come across.
I think the most interesting country in all of this is actually Germany.
Vital.
And then the Schroeder stuff was really interesting. He goes off to St. Petersburg, gets embraced physically by Putin. But that's a real sign of this, in some ways, an East-West divide that we've seen. There's a lot of people in East Germany who actually want to counter Western influence, who thinks that Russia is misunderstood. And yes, okay, didn't necessarily... I have to say Angela Merkel is not among these. But German politics on Russia...
She speaks Putin Russian.
She does, but I don't think she's as sympathetic as others are within the German regime or even the German state. And I think it's interesting that you are seeing much more of a dividing line between the tough stance the United States appears to be making and Europe, which necessarily, because of the geographical closeness of it all, is a bit more dependent and a bit more kind of culturally in tune with Russia.
Well, talking of that, there was a most extraordinary piece in the New York Times last week, Why the Germans Love Russian. And it was a right winger who was writing, saying, well, of course, the Germans aren't really European. What? You know, and it was this that they were playing, if we could be a little cultural about this. You know, the great Eisenstein movie, Alexander Nevsky, you could hear the strains of Prokofiev coming on, the battle on the ice. These are really people who are beyond the borders of civilization, as perceived by the New York Times, and are operating on the outer fringes of Europe. It was just completely bonkers, as they say in France.
But also a country that for 50 years had a pretty big Soviet sphere of influence on them. But there we go.
You're listening to Midori House with Emma Nelson, Robert Fox and Darren McCaffrey. Luckily, in a moment, we shall be continuing the discussion of Germany. Stay with us.
This week on The Foreign Desk, we peer somewhat optimistically over the horizon to ask what an independent Palestinian state might look like.
There will be so much goodwill around the world once a deal is struck between the Israelis and the Palestinians that I really believe the state could accomplish remarkable things for its people and for the region. It's just getting there that is just so devilishly difficult.
Peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians may have reached a stalemate, but if they were to succeed, how would an independent Palestine survive?
There is a bright future, I believe, to have a sound economy. Now we changed the way we play the game here in Palestine. We're producing products that can compete.
We hear from commentators, entrepreneurs, and established business owners on their hopes for an independent Palestine.
People are talking about one state solution as a way out of this impasse that is much more promising for both people, the Israelis and the Palestinians.
That's the state of Palestine, this week's edition of The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, on Monocle 24.
It's 22 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson, joined in the studio by a lively Robert Fox and Darren McCaffrey today. Now, an article written in a British newspaper has asked the question, does Germany rule our world? As well as the obvious day-to-day paraphernalia of cars, white goods and gummy bears, are we subject more wholesale to Germany's influence? And if 25 years after being sellotaped back together, the country can do this well, what are the future? And with Europe going to the polls next Thursday, how will the continent's voting be influenced by its approval or otherwise of Germany? Still with me, as I was saying, is Robert Fox and Darren McCaffrey. Let's start with you, Darren. Do you believe that Germany rules your world?
Germany does rule our world. I'm going to say yes in answer to this, simply because obviously you've got three big nations in the European Union. One of them that really doesn't play a big part, or tries not to, in terms of the UK. And one which is kind of, during the Eurozone crisis, soared ahead, and that is Germany, while France has kind of, certainly kind of fallen on its baguette. And so, we have to remember, so Germany's economy has grown so much in the last few years, primarily through exports. That's allowed it to prop up the Eurozone, to hand out checks left, right and centre to the pig countries. But in a sense, to its own benefit, of course, because we all know that Germany wants the Eurozone to stay intact because it ultimately means that Germany benefits most by keeping its goods at a much lower price than if the thing was to fall apart. But should we be pleased that Germany does this? Well, I think we should. I mean, we all kind of benefit. I think there's a statistic in here that says that a third of all the household appliances in UK homes come from Germany. They make high-end products, they make it very good, and at the same time, they do boost the rest of the European economy, in that lots of their goods are made with other European goods that they import in. So I think, yes, Germany is by far the most influential country in Europe. And I think it's a good thing.
Robert, Darren is enjoying his white goods and his nice cars, courtesy of Germany. But if you are living in the likes of Greece, Spain, Portugal, your perspective is possibly slightly different towards Germany, and maybe not just Germany, but more in particular, its Chancellor.
Yes, I think the problem with Greece, put to me very eloquently by a diplomat who's married to a Greek lady who actually died last year, but he has taken up Greek domicile, is that, and he worked in the British Foreign Office looking after German affairs. So he put it absolutely beautifully that if it is so vital, as Darrow says, the whole EU to the German economy, then you must behave towards the outer fringes of the market as if it is part of your country. That is the problem with Greece. You cannot expect to screw them down, although Greece is recovering, and give them no credit at all, and expect them to still go on buying your goods and services and yet resisting what they have to offer. The most interesting thing, and I would say this, and I've spent a lot of time this year, the most interesting game going on, and Time magazine flagged this up, is Italy. Not only Mr. Renzi, but also Mr. Draghi, the chairman of the European Central Bank. I happen to know through a mutual friend that Draghi has always thought it's 50-50 whether the euro would last. And he's made this view plain to Merkel. And unless Germany adjusts, it's going to probably fall apart within the next 4 or 5 years. And this really is the problem with Germany at the moment. Like all the rest of us, it's just a creature of the moment. The thing that is worrying about Germany is genuinely strategically. It does not seem, this chancellorship too, does not seem to be able to see much beyond this evening, let alone tomorrow.
Robert kind of slipped there and talked about Europe as well, the Eurozone. And we have to remember, we have got these elections next Thursday. 500 million people. I'm sure all of them will be queuing up to vote.
I've lost my ballot paper.
we have to remember, I mean, tonight is crucial moment. There is a live TV debate, which I'm sure we'll all be tuning into, between the rivals for the Commission presidents. All those familiar names, Martin Schulz, the former Prime Minister of Luxembourg. We've got Guy Verhofstadt, the former Prime Minister of Belgium. All these big
Mr.
names.
Mr. Poofs, no doubt, will be coming in.
What will be most fascinating, though, and this obviously has a big influence on the Eurozone, is the anti-EU vote, not just in the UK and France, but pretty much across every single European country. Which
the
is
smaller
going to have
countries
big
are going to be very interesting.
Places like the Netherlands.
We're focused on Farage. We must watch Mr. Wilders is doing in the Freedom Party.
I'm afraid, gentlemen, we must drag you away from the EU.
We didn't even discuss Grace Kelly.
We're just about to.
The timeless camp classic.
I know you brought your frock in especially, Robert, because the Cannes Film Festival is in its second day. It's fair to say day two of festivities on the Croisette have been coloured by a reaction to this.
I can be a mother and a wife and hold down two jobs without the people getting too upset, can't I?
But what about the prince?
What about the prince? The prince is very supportive.
Ray is never going to accept the idea of his princess going back into the movies. You know that, Gracie.
I don't know. It's always politics with him.
Mr. President, I've already given our allegiance.
You expect all of Monaco.
That's not negotiation. That's extortion.
A snippet of the biopic of Grace Kelly, who became, of course, Princess Grace of Monaco, played by an astonishingly faced Nicole Kidman, Darren McCaffrey. This has had an absolutely delightful pasting. It's been more fun to read the reviews, and I obviously suspect it will be to watch the film. This is where the biopic's gone wrong.
Yeah, and it hasn't quite a lot in recent years. We'll remember the Diana one as well. I mean, my favourite quote on this is from Empire's Damien Wise. He said, it's an easy watch, it's lush, it's stylish, it's often side-splittingly funny. The trouble is, it's not actually meant to be a comedy. And apparently there was just laughter during the press screening on Wednesday. Now, it must be said that it's been, I mean, that's a pretty easy, but it's been pretty panned by the critics. But that has not stopped the defence of the film, even though the family have also criticised it as well. I mean, we've heard from Nicole Kidman saying that actually she is incredibly proud of this film as one of the best things she has done, and that she is She's devastated.
Robert, you are chuckling with excitement at telling us what makes a good biopic.
Is Nicole Kidman on YouTube trying to justify it, which is wonderful. The other thing I would say to enter a devastating, acidic drop of journalism into this, that the real story of Grace Kelly and Rainier and her father and the whole bit and how she died is a damn sight more interesting than any mainstream film producer or company or director would dare put out.
Where is it, therefore, that you've seen the problems with this one? Where did biopics succeed? I mean, I can think of Capote and Milk as being quite good examples, but they're few and far between, aren't they?
Although I didn't see it because somebody advised me not to. I don't even think, but I've seen it extensively in clips, I don't even think that Meryl Streep, class act, was as good as the hype and the Oscar said as Margaret Thatcher either.
No, well, that was...
The real story was so complicated and fascinating, as Charles Moore's biography, whatever, has shown that, you know, it was a bit of a waste of space.
I think the big problem is that often the people's lives are trying to portray they're so big and so well known that it is impossible almost for anyone to
try
and react.
It works better on television than it does on the movies.
It does.
Churchill's been done well on telly.
And Tommy Cooper as well.
Gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there.
Frankie
Robert Hearn. Fox, defence editor for the Evening Standard here in London, and Darren McCaffrey for Sky News here in the UK. Thank you very much indeed for joining
us
on Midori House.
Thank you.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
런던으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦，这是 Monocle 24.
Orlando, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. 런던으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We head to Norway today to talk eggs and Constitution Day, and we'll review the latest book releases. And before the end of the programme, we raise our glasses to wish a happy birthday to... But before all that, with the time at 31 minutes past the hour, who's Suzanne with the latest?
Thank you, Emma. More than 100 people are still unaccounted for 2 days after a mine explosion in Turkey that killed at least 282 people. There have been angry demonstrations in several cities and a day of national strike action to protest about safety concerns at the Soma mine. The British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has condemned what he called Syria's ruthless utter disregard for human life. He's hosted a meeting of foreign ministers from the Friends of Syria group in London. The president of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan, is to visit the village of Chibok, from where more than 200 schoolgirls were kidnapped a month ago. His government has ruled out Boko Haram's demand for a prisoner exchange to guarantee the teenagers' safe return. Moscow insists it's not had any formal request from the Donetsk region of Ukraine for it to be absorbed into the Russian Federation. Separatist leaders in the province had said they'd push for the move following the independence referendum. And the five candidates for the EU's top job will take part in their biggest televised debate yet shortly. Millions of people are expected to watch the contenders to be president of the European Commission. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Suzanne. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is, 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 14:32 if you're listening in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Let's speak to Monocle's Oslo correspondent, Lars Bavanger, who joins me now. Welcome to Midori House, Lars. Let's begin with a story that's quite shocking insofar as some quite serious bits of information have been withheld from the Norwegian public.
Yeah, that's right. The daily newspaper VG earlier this week broke the story of how Norway's Public Roads Administration had been holding back very important traffic accident reports. Now, they are in charge alongside with the police to investigate whenever there's been a serious accident involving a serious injury or death. The police do the preliminary investigations and then the Public Roads Administration do the more detailed stuff. Now, what's happened is that they've kept the conclusion secret, and lawyers now say that their clients who might have been sentenced to prison for causing accidents could have got away with it more leniently if all the facts had been known. For instance, there were some reports that said that the road layout was wrong or the signage was faulty. So it's a very serious story which might have some repercussions.
Did they give any indication as to why this information was withheld?
Well, the Roads Administration says that they have kept details of their reports secret or away from public scrutiny because they contain a lot of very personal information, but that doesn't seem to be washing with the Norwegian media or with anyone who's lost people in accidents or someone who's been involved in a serious accident who might have got a stronger sentence in the courts than they might have had if all the facts had been known at the time.
You mentioned some of the reasons why these accidents took place were to do with the quality of the roads being partially responsible. I mean, to what degree is that a burning issue in Norway? Because it's never struck me that the transport infrastructure was in need of much repair.
No, I mean, the transport infrastructure is pretty good in Norway, but there are complicated junctions, for instance, where accidents do happen, and this happens in other countries as well. It might be a brand new junction which has been relatively well thought out, but in reality it turns out that it might become confusing in certain situations in certain times of day or night, and that when an accident happens and an investigation is launched, it turns out that things that haven't been thought through actually surface when you look at it very closely.
Let's move on to Norwegian farmers who are unable to strike for some very obvious reasons. But what they are doing is they are doing go slows and blockading the delivery of eggs around the country. Why is that?
Well, they are protesting against the government. Now, farmers in Norway are very heavily subsidised. They're already given about £1.3 billion a year, and that's because it's a very hilly and chilly country. So if you want to compete in agriculture in Norway with huge European agricultural nations like France, for instance, you need a lot of state help. They renegotiate this deal with the government every year. This year, they broke off negotiations when the government only offered them an extra £15 million. They wanted 10 times that. So in protest, they've chosen to block the egg delivery. Now, why eggs, you might wonder? It might be because we're coming up to the biggest national holiday in Norway, 17th of May, which is when everyone celebrates Norway's constitution, which is 200 years old this year. And everyone wants to bake cakes for that occasion. And without eggs, no cakes, of course.
We'll move on to Constitution Day or May the 17th in just a few moments' time. But just briefly staying with eggs, when supply is generally restricted to the general public don't normally support those who are carrying out the strike. They tend to be rather against them. Do the Norwegian egg farmers or do the Norwegian farmers believe that they will achieve anything by this?
Well, what they say is that the message they're sending out is that people in Norway shouldn't take Norwegian agricultural products for granted. This is not something that, you know, comes to your shop as if by magic. There's actually a lot of hard work behind it, but also obviously they need a lot of state support. So it's a way for them to alert people to the fact of how things actually work. But yes, absolutely, I don't think they'll get a lot of sympathy with the public if they can't get their eggs in time for the cake.
So assuming that a cake is able to be made, and we all are wishing, you're going to have to help me on the pronunciation here of the Sitten de May, tell us what the 17th of May is like in Norway each year. There have been various different ways of warning people about how to prepare for the big day, haven't there?
Yes, it's a huge public celebration where everyone's out in their finery in the streets. There's huge parades with children from all the schools around the country parading behind brass bands, and there's lots of flag waving. Actually, for someone who comes from another country and sees it unawares, might think it's a nationalistic rally. It might be a bit overwhelming with all those flags, but it's very good-natured, and it's basically celebrating Norway's constitution, which was was signed in 1814, so 200 years ago this year, and that was the beginning of Norway's independence from neighbouring Sweden. So it's a celebration of Norway's independence. The papers are full of advice on how to avoid blisters when you walk around in those parades in your poshest shoes, and also where to get the cheapest flags, hot dogs, ice creams, pop, champagne and beer. And of course, if you don't have the eggs, you might need quite a lot of the two last items to make the day good.
Does it become one of those cost-cutting things? I know that you get these awful adverts in the run-up to Christmas where everybody tells you how you can get everything for a certain amount of money. It kind of takes the fun out of things.
It does a bit. It's a bit cheesy, you might think. And I think most Norwegians don't think about the cost that much. They'll fork out for the champagne, which they usually drink for a champagne breakfast, and don't really look at the cost so much. Norway's very wealthy now because of the oil and gas, and most people are pretty much well off. But, you know, there'll always be the people who are looking for a bargain, even for a very big national holiday like this.
Lars Bevanger, I hope you have your champagne and heels at the ready.
I do.
Good man. Yeah, Oslo correspondent, thank you very much as ever for joining us on the programme. You're listening to Midori House, where the time here in London is just nudging 40 minutes past the hour. Up next, we assess how the American comic book hero has fared in Japan in the 1960s as Batman turns 75.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
You're back with Midori House. The time here in London is 41 minutes past the hour. Let's wish a very happy birthday. He's been looking after himself as well and clearly slathering on the Astrolift. Batman is 75 years old this year. One of the most famous faces in American comic book history. There's one chapter of the Batman story that has little been told. In the mid-1960s, the Batman franchise was licensed by DC Comics to Japan for Japanese artists to produce their own version of Bruce Lee and his adventures. It's the only country in the world ever to have been allowed to do so. Helen McCarthy is a historian of Japanese comics, and she gave us this assessment of the role the American comic book hero has played in Japanese pop culture.
Japan in the 1960s was a place not that different from Britain in, let's say, the late 40s, early 50s. Britain in the 60s had begun to recover its confidence and its energy, but Japan was still very poor. It had been bombed to rubble. It had very little working infrastructure. It was occupied by the Americans, who right up until they left in the 50s had been heavily censoring the whole of Japanese media, although the Japanese didn't find that out till about the mid-80s. But it was a very depressed place. It was a place where social structures had been dismantled overnight. It was a place where family structures had broken down under the impact of having so many men of working, marriageable father, grandfather age being killed or coming back from war with the terrible things war does to a person. So Japan was a society that had completely lost its sense of self. But suddenly, there in the 60s, there were all these wonderful things flooding in from the rest of the world with confidence and energy and enthusiasm. And Japanese kids, and Japanese particularly artists and creators, started to say, OK, we've had enough of apologising for the war. This is a new world. We're going to make Japan's place in it.
And did you find there was one medium which attracted Japanese creative types most? Was it film? Was it music, literature, art?
Well, art had a hard time in Japan because traditional art was very, very entrenched and was encouraged by the Americans, provided it didn't have anything too militaristic. But avant-garde art which had been very big in Japan before the war, they had some wonderful futurists and some marvellous early conceptual artists, had a really tough time. There was a lot of reactionism, there was a lot of right-wing movement away from trying to self-identify back with the old Japan. An artist like Yoko Ono, for instance, had to leave Japan in order to flourish. But in pop culture that caters to kids, which is often considered the cheapest end of pop culture, there was an enormous enthusiasm for retelling and remaking stories. And so in kids' comics, manga, and in cartoons, animation on TV and anime, people began to find a way of expressing themselves that was kind of under the radar. For example, all through the American censorship, most of the time the censors didn't bother to censor kids' comics because they were kids' comics. Who cares? And so a lot of really subversive stuff, a lot of very interesting retellings and psychological workings out of Japan's role in the war and Japan's defeat came through in kids' comics. And this was still happening in the 60s, at a time when Japanese students were picking up on the world counterculture movements that had gone from Paris across Europe, starting to go across America. So there was a real perception that, yes, things had been terrible and things were going to change, but now we're going to build something from all this rubble, and it's going to be new. It's not going to be like the old world.
And we know just how popular manga is, of course, mm-hmm. still today. It's just exploded on the world stage, not just in Japan, really all around the world. But let's focus back in the late 1960s, particularly Bat Manga and the Japanese version of that.
Oh, well, that was really interesting because there was still a perception, and this was largely encouraged by the occupying forces, the Allies, the Americans, that Japan was a very different sort of market. And of course, that was partly justified by its language. Trust me, learning Japanese is hard. And for the Japanese, learning English is even harder. I've talked to a great many Japanese friends who all say, how do you cope with a language that only has 26 letter forms? You know, how can you do everything you need to do in that? So there was a big barrier to overcome with all pop culture products. But there were all these wonderful things in America, which had already made their money in America for Marvel and DC and were being sold overseas cheaper, that the Japanese thought if we could only get our hands on them and we could get them out in our marketplace, we could sell to our kids. But there's that big barrier of that clunky language that so few people speak. I know. Instead of buying the stuff, why don't we buy the right to do the stuff and give our guys who are brilliant at comics and brilliant at cartoons a big pile of papers and say, write a story broadly along these lines about this teenage kid who is suddenly bitten by a spider and gets superpowers and he has to live in urban Tokyo and nobody can know about him and there's this girl he loves and suddenly you've got the Japanese Spider-Man. Or let's have this story about this dashing hero, this suave, sophisticated, elegant man like a Japanese upper-class aristocrat before the war, who's right on the cutting edge, who's really engaged with technology and with cool weapons and cool stuff, and who has a young sidekick who's taking the viewer's role, kind of looking up to him and learning from him. Let's have him, but let's get him done by one of our guys so we don't have to translate.
And we also know there, of course, was the Japanese version of Superman as well.
Oh, indeed, yes. Although for some reason, Superman never seemed to take quite as well with the Japanese as Batman did.
Why?
I'm not sure. I think possibly it's because Batman was perceived as more integrated into society. You know, Batman has a social role. He's an industrialist. He's an employer. He's a representative of an old family. He's carrying family honour. And I think not many people have thought about how that must have resonated with the Japanese, where there were a great many families who'd lost fathers and sons in the war and where maybe just one person was now carrying the tradition of an old name. So Batman had a lot of resonances with Japanese society. Superman was a total alien. Superman was an alien everywhere. Nice guy, you know, really nice guy, but not so easy to relate to. And also, Superman had superpowers. Batman, you have to remember, had no powers he didn't earn himself. And although the Japanese Batman flirts a little bit more with the supernatural and the unreal than the American Batman does, Batman himself works for his powers, whereas Superman is like all these big GIs who stormed into the country in 1945, huge, strange, with all their strength and all their confidence handed to them on a plate. Superman, I think, was too much like the invader. Batman gave the Japanese a way to imagine themselves in his role and in Robin's role.
Fascinating stuff there from Helen McCarthy of The Legacy of American Comic Characters in Japan. She's speaking to Phil Han there, especially about why Superman didn't work and Batman did. You can hear a special report on Batman's foray into Japan on next week's edition of Section D. In the meantime, on Midori House, the time at 18:48 here in London, let's play you a bit of music. Let's move from Gotham City's resident hero to New York to Spider-Man. It was a bit of a clunk, but this is... No, I'm lying to you. I've got Superman instead. I'm all confused with my superheroes. This is the Flaming Lips. From their 1999 album, The Soft Bulletin, that was Waiting for a Superman by The Flaming Lips. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time here in London is 18:53, and it is customary at this bit of in the programme to talk books. I'm delighted to say that Fleur MacDonald, the editor of The Omnivore and creator of the Hatchet Job of the Year Award, joins me in the studio with a fistful of new publications. Lovely to have you in the studio, Fleur. In your hand, or in my hand, I must say, is a book that I wondered was ever going to be published. There is the famous British interviewer, famous in the United Kingdom at least, Lynn Barber. She's made a name for conducting very, very strong interviews where her personality shines as much as that of her subject. She's written an autobiography about her career.
Yes, she has. It's actually a follow-on to her memoir, An Education, which was made into a film, where she is seduced by an evil con man. And here, this is the follow-up. So she talks about her career, which has been very varied. She started off working for Penthouse and then ended up interviewing people as varied as Marianne Faithfull, Shane McGowan, Martin Clunes, James Stewart. I mean, the list is endless.
I found it quite strange to see her popping up in all the Sunday supplements in the last couple of weeks, given the fact that she is normally the one who hides behind her pen. Although her character is so strong, isn't it?
Well, she actually talks about this in the book. She says that she was one of the first interviewers to talk about themselves. So she talks about her mood before the interview, what happened. And I think actually it's quite honest because interviews can be a completely subjective experience. So whether she likes, if she likes Martin Clunes, it might be just because she was in a good mood that day or he was in a good mood that day. And so it's just meant to be kind of a snapshot of both the interviewees and her own how they felt on that day.
She does briefly sort of talk about her interview technique. She's talking about our actors in this one bit, and she said a good question is, who do you have dinner with most nights on location? She's talking about interviewing actors. They say they don't say they're co-star because it sounds as if they're having an affair. On the other hand, they don't like to say they're stunt double because it sounds as if they're gay. Safest answer is the director, or usually that's the last thing that anybody would be wanting to do. She talks about there's no way into the inner life of actors, and God knows she says she's tried. To what degree do you actually think that Lynn Barber ever gets to the core of who she's talking to? And I mean, she's obviously this book shows her dogged attempt.
Well, I think that, as I said, it really depends on that person's mood that day, but she uses interview techniques that are very simple and they just work. So she asks questions, open-ended questions. She's interested in what people say, and she says that that was what she was like ever since she was small. So she was the one in the playground that was asked to go up to the cool girl and ask her whether she snogged X in the cinema last week, and that's exactly what she does to these famous people that she's interviewing.
The chutzpah of the interviewer. Let's move on to what's the other book you've brought in today, Fleur?
So I also chose Edward St. Aubyn's Lost for Words, and this is so he's famous for the Patrick Melrose series, which were a thinly disguised account of his rather turbulent life. And now he's moved on to writing a satire on thinly veiled satire on the Booker Prize. He calls it the Elysian Prize. In fact, he, in 2011, the last book of the Melrose series wasn't wasn't longlisted. And I mean, there were lots of interviews about this because, I mean, he got asked about this a lot because it was a surprise. And he said to an interviewer, "I'm not going to spend a lot of my time thinking about a prize I can't win. The Booker Prize 2011 is of no more interest to me than the World Heavyweight Championship, which I'm not going to win either."
And so, and then comes Lost for Words, a dish one would argue would say is just being served cold. It's been touted as the literary equivalent of Scoop, which is something which is really not, you know, quite an ambitious comparison. Does he do it?
Basically, I think Scoop is a great book because you have tremendous affection for William Boot. But here, there are no characters that you can really grasp onto. The only character that you kind of have some sympathy for is one that's actually must be based on Edward St. Aubyn himself, because he's in the running for his Buildings Roman of, well, I'm quoting here, the impeccable anguish and undisguised autobiographical origin, which is basically what the Melrose series was.
Fleur, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for joining me in the studio. That's all we have time for today's Midori House. Thanks in particular to our special guest Robert Fox from the Evening Standard and Darren McCaffrey from Sky News here in the United Kingdom, and to Fleur too, who's still sitting next to me. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alex May, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. My thanks to them all. At 2200 hours, you can tune in to the Monocle Daily. Andrew Muller and Ted Kravitz at the helm for that. This show, Midori House, will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Emma Nelson. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.